800 years ago, this happened.
We want a council to represent rich people. We want a free church with a free steeple. We want you to stop stealing our sons and holding them hostage like you have done.
There's vital stuff here that you've got to give us. There's also some stuff about fishing in the rivers.
Feels strange, but yes, it only took 800 years for the history of King John and the signing of Magna Carta to go from founding Declaration of Human Rights to a question on social studies quizzes to become a hip-hop track courtesy of the BBC right there. British Prime Minister David Cameron spoke with more gravitas today at the site of the actual signing of MC.
Magna Carta is something every person in Britain should be proud of. Its remaining copies may be faded, but its principles shine as brightly as ever. In every courtroom and every classroom, from palace to parliament to parish church, liberty, justice, democracy, the rule of law, we hold these things dear, and we should hold them even dearer for the fact that they took shape right here on the banks of the Thames.
And the person responsible for enforcing what some of those rule of law ideas became much later in the USA, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, also spoke from Runnymede, England.
Even today, America continues to pursue these goals. We are engaged in initiatives to promote trust and understanding.
Lynch and Cameron were joined by Queen Elizabeth II and scholars and dignitaries from around the world celebrating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. The document itself can be seen in the British Museum. Its relevance to today's notions of human rights are a matter for historians to debate. Tom McSweeney, assistant professor at William & Mary Law School, reminds us that Magna Carta was about some very local issues in England, not some universal declaration for future generations to embrace.
Well, it was designed to address issues that a lot of people had with the royal government in the early 13th century, particularly issues that the wealthiest landowners in England had against the king, the barons, the people who really held the largest plots of land. But there were other people who were angry at royal government, the bishops, the city of London. And Magna Carta is really kind of a miscellaneous list of grievances that various people in England had against arbitrary financial exactions, John's bad relationship with the English church, things like that.
And that's why in the send-up there from the BBC, there's a discussion of fishing in the Magna Carta, which relates to all these very specific details concerning land rights.
Absolutely. There are provisions in the charter that have to do with removing fish wares from the Thames and the Medway, so fish traps, basically, because the citizens of London were concerned about navigation up those rivers. But there are provisions about things like, one of them says, we shall have a uniform measure of wine throughout our kingdom. There's one on bridge building. That's one of my favorites. In the middle of a very technical series of chapters on the administration of the royal courts, there's a chapter that says no one will be constrained to build bridges unless they've been required to for a long time. And I just sort of imagine somebody ran into the room while they were discussing the royal courts and said, don't forget the bridges, you know, or something like that. There are all these very specific provisions that we don't really read much about today.
Is it the case that the Magna Carta crystallized a sense of universal human rights that was already developing in the 13th century that King John kind of understood he had to agree with here? Or was this something fundamentally novel?
Well, there are a couple of different ways to think about that, actually, in the 13th century. On the one hand, Magna Carta is a very specific text. It's not about something universal. Charters of liberties were something that were fairly common in the early 13th century. And we should think about liberties. They're more like what we would call privileges today. So people were buying special exemptions from the law in charters of liberties. They were often purchased. And Magna Carta is sort of that. It's a series of special exemptions from the law. What's novel about it is that it's exemptions of the law from the general rule of law that apply to the entire kingdom. So that these things are, in a sense, posed in terms of exemptions from the law, but they're universal at the same time. So it is novel in that sense, that it's universalizing something that was before very specific.
And take us through the path of how some of these rights in the Magna Carta become inflated and underscored down through history to really connect with the liberties and the Bill of Rights that we understand today as being universal. How did it go from this very local event to something very global.
It's actually there's some very interesting historical developments there. I think one of the most interesting is the development of the idea that Magna Carta guarantees the trial by jury. So that chapter 39, the language by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land, has been read to guarantee the jury right. And in fact, language from Magna Carta and from statutes interpreting Magna Carta ended up in the U.S. Constitution when the jury right was written into the Bill of Rights. No one intended it to guarantee trial by jury in the 13th century. We know this partly because trial by jury wasn't the primary way of trying criminals in the early 13th century. It became the primary way of trying criminals by the 1220s, but it was because of another major event of 1215, the Fourth Lateran Council, which was an ecumenical council of the church, which met in Rome in 1215. And the Fourth Lateran Council was a very significant event, but one of the things it did was it said that clerics can't participate in trial by ordeal anymore. These are trials, or for instance, you dunk somebody in water to see if they sink or they float to determine their innocence or guilt. That was the primary way of trying criminals in England in 1215. And by the 1220s, because of the Fourth Lateran Council, the courts have switched over to using juries because they can't use ordeals anymore. No one thought it was because of Magna Carta. It's centuries later that people start to associate Magna Carta with the right to a criminal jury. William Penn is one of the big progenitors of this myth, the Quaker leader and founder of Pennsylvania. Quakers were very big on juries because they were being tried for illegal religious meetings. And they argued that juries had the right to acquit when they disagreed with the law. William Penn argued during one of his trials that Magna Carta guaranteed trial by jury and actually wrote language into the laws of Pennsylvania and New Jersey that mirrored Magna Carta when he wrote the jury right into their laws.
And made it into the U.S. Constitution. It's amazing to see the actual document there in the British Museum. How does it make you feel to look at it?
Well, it's always interesting to I love going over to the UK and looking at the original documents, knowing that, you know, a 13th century scribe wrote this out. Having that connection with a person in the 13th century is pretty neat.
Tom McSweeney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tom McSweeney talking about Magna Carta there as assistant professor at William and Mary Law School.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.